Drawing room over here.
You made it. Oh, come on through. Do you fancy drink? What's your tipple? Welcome to The Drawing Room, a space for intimate and surprising conversations. I'm Andy Park. Nature, as we've been told, is survival of the fittest, a fight to be the best and damn everything else. But have we missed the forest for the trees here? As we learn more about the environment around us, we find complex layers of cooperation that allow the world to survive and also to thrive. Kristen Olson is an award-winning writer, and in her latest book, Sweet in Tooth and Claw, Kristen looks at the changing understanding of nature and our own place within it. Kristen's my guest in the drawing room. Welcome to you. Come on in and take a seat.
Thank you, Andy.
You note in your introduction that, quote, we find what we're looking for, end quote. So why do so many of us, including ecologists, understand nature as a battle, as binary, red in tooth and claw, as you quote Tennyson?
Well, I think that that is part of our cultural and scientific history. You know, we have ideas that have come to us from Darwin and other scientists. And I think in many cases, we have misinterpreted some of those ideas to look at life as being a bloody competition. And I think it's also, you know, it's also somewhat in our nature to pay more attention to danger, to threat, because paying attention to danger and to threat is what kept us alive as a species for so many years. But it's so easy for us to overlook the cooperation and the generosity that holds everything together.
Yeah, generosity is an interesting word, a very human word, or we understand it as a very human word. You don't often hear that as an overlay for relationships or dynamics in nature. Let's talk about some examples of this cooperation at the heart of your book. You write about mutualism and the relationship between bees and plants. How does that cooperation work, and why doesn't each side try and cheat the other?
Well, mutualism, and I didn't really even understand this term before I started writing this book, even though I had certainly watched my share of bees pollinating flowers. But mutualism is the mutually beneficial relationship between different species. So one of the ones that we do see the most, we see it every day because it's such a wonderful thing to watch, is this relationship between bees and other pollinators and plants. You know, plants create a carbon fuel, a sugary liquid through photosynthesis. You know, through photosynthesis, they're creating this carbon fuel, which they use to power their own growth and all that. But some of it they use for other purposes. And one of the purposes with flowers is that they, you know, they exude, they offer a nectar to bees and other pollinators. And so bees and other pollinators come to those plants and search for the nectar, and bees also search for some pollen. And in the process of searching for that nectar, they get their bodies covered with pollen, and then they go off and look for more nectar. And what they're in effect doing is spreading that pollen throughout the population of those plants and fertilizing those plants. So the bees are providing a service to the plants and the flowers, helping them fertilize and make seeds and fruits. And the flowers are obviously benefiting the bees and other pollinators. And anyway, this is one of the most obvious mutualistic relationships that we see in nature, but they're all over. They're in the ground under, you know, when we're walking around, there's a constant mutualistic exchange between plants and the billions of microorganisms that are in the soil that live around those plants that are in exchange for those, again, those carbon sugars that plants make during photosynthesis. These microorganisms are bringing the plants nutrients, they're bringing the plants, in some cases, water, in some cases, they're bringing the plants chemical messages. So this kind of cooperation that I write about in the book, I mean, it just undergirds everything in the world that we see around us.
It's a particularly important and pertinent example when it comes to bees and pollination in this country at the moment, as the Varroa mite threatens the viability of the almond industry, because obviously bees help to pollinate almond trees and thus grow almonds. And we're seeing the widespread destruction of beehives, certainly on the east coast of this country, due to the Varroa mite. So it's certainly a very interesting example of how their cooperation can come unstuck, mainly due to humans. Salmon may be another unusual form of cooperation. They rush to spawn upriver, and it's a great feast. It's quite a sight, a spectacle that we don't have in this country for animals, and their reliance on the protein that the salmon bring. But it might also be important for the forest. Why is that?
Yeah, that's so fascinating. One of the researchers that I spoke to talked about the salmon shadow on the land, and that is the shadow of a certain kind of a form of nitrogen that salmon have in their body that they bring from the deep ocean up those streams. And when they are caught by bears and I've even seen coyotes grab salmon out of a stream. When they're caught by these animals and then taken out into the forest to be eaten, you know, the bears eat some of that salmon and leave the rest of it on the ground to rot. And the salmon, the nitrogen from those salmon is leached out of the body and carried through the forest by these mycorrhizal fungi, these fungi that live in the forest floor that send out these silky strands of connection between all the trees and the plants in the forest. And the nutrients from that rotting salmon, that nitrogen feast, is carried out and fertilizes all those plants in the forest.
What are mother trees? This is a bit of a tangent to when we talk about fungi and mycelium, but what are mother trees?
Actually, that was the work of that scientist was what prompted my interest in this whole subject. I mean, I had written a book before this called The Soil Will Save Us, mostly about how farmers and scientists and ranchers are learning that we have to treat the land differently. And if we treat the land differently, especially through ranching and farming, that we can actually have soil that holds carbon and builds carbon instead of releasing carbon. And fascinating moments for me writing that book was that understanding that plants and soil microorganisms have this giving partnership. And anyway, so I was fixated on that idea of the giving partnership. And then I went to a conference where I heard Suzanne Simard, who is a Canadian forest ecologist, talking about her mother tree project. So she is studying many things, and her work has just been fundamental for people around the world understanding that a forest is a giant community of connection, that there are these fungi under the forest floor that are connecting the roots of all these trees and plants in the forest and sort of radiating nutrients and water and chemical messages throughout the forest and helping the forest overall survive. And anyway, she's interested in studying the very oldest trees in the forest, which she calls the mother tree. And what's so fascinating about these trees is not only that, you know, that they're big and old and that they've survived for many years, but that they have all these relationships. They have all these relationships with, you know, up to 200 different species of fungi. So because they've been there so long, they've developed all these relationships. And because of these relationships that they have with these fungi, their connection and their helping connection, their benevolence with all these trees in the forest is even greater. I mean, even greater than a smaller tree.
It's just so fascinating when you think about that sort of level of connection. Sometimes there are ideas like mother trees, which might make environmental sense, but in the argument against them, it's economic. It might be more efficient to plant a single type of tree, clear cut, and then replant it. But you found that even the economic argument might not be true there. What do you mean by that?
Well, that again was part of Suzanne Simard's work. You know, when she first started working for the timber industry. Her family had been, you know, her grandfather and her uncles, and they had all worked harvesting trees in Canada. And she, after college, started working for a private timber company and then as a government timber scientist. And, you know, there was this idea that the most profitable, the most productive way to raise trees for timber was to grow them like a giant cornfield, you know, one species of tree planted in rows, bare lanes between them, and no other plants other than that one tree growing there, because the idea was that there was too much competition, that these other plants would compete for water, would compete for nutrients, and take away from the vigor of that crop, that one crop that they wanted. So she started doing research in forests where she was trying to figure out, well, okay, if this makes sense. And at this point, she still thought it probably made sense. So she started removing some of these other trees that naturally grew with the tree, the conifer, the Douglas fir that she was studying and that the timber company was trying to grow. She started removing these other plants to see what level of competition, what reduced level of competition was the best for these, for this timber crop. And she found exactly the opposite, that the more she removed these other trees, the sicker the timber, the crop timber became. And she started to understand that there was a giving relationship that was going on there that humans weren't privy to, that we just weren't aware of the fact that, yes, there is some competition for nutrients and for water, but there's also a lot of giving going on there. And then she went on to conduct research and has been doing that throughout her career on, well, what are those relationships? What are these plants giving to each other? And how can we, in a commercial operation like a timber business, respect those relationships and have a profitable timber harvest?
On ABCRN, I'm Andy Park. Kristen Olson is my guest in the drawing room. We're talking about her fascinating new book, Sweet in Tooth and Claw, which in part looks at the kind of collaboration or cooperation happening at sometimes unseen levels in nature all around us. I mean, you found a very different movement away from those sort of commercial farming ideas, going back to the idea of cooperation. Introduce us to Jonathan Lundgren and his path to the farm.
Well, he is somebody, again, that I interviewed in my last book. He is an entomologist who used to work for the U.S. government, for the USDA. So he used to work for the USDA doing research on the effects of different pesticides on crops. And his research showed that a lot of the pesticides that farmers were using that seed and chemical companies had told them would help them be more profitable were actually not helping them, you know, and many times they weren't killing the pest that they said that they would. And anyway, they were not as helpful as the farmers were promised they would be. And finally, he became discouraged by the research directions that he was prodded into at the USDA, and he went off on his own. And now he is an independent scientist who works with a lot of universities, and more importantly, he works with a lot of farmers, helping them figure out why some of the things that they're doing. And these are farmers who are trying to depart from the industrial agriculture model. You know, so some of them are no-till farmers. Some of them are farmers who are trying to farm without chemicals. Some of them are farmers who are really trying to incorporate a very big ecosystem idea into their farming, so that if they're growing corn, for instance, they'll still have the rows of corn, but between those rows of corn, they'll have all sorts of other plants growing, so that those plants can both protect the soil and enrich the soil and harbor a big community of beneficial insects. So he is helping some of these farmers understand why the things that they're doing are helping or hurting. And he's also, you know, trying to provide more of the the research oomph to this other form of agriculture, which many people call regenerative agriculture. You know, it's agriculture that takes an ecosystem approach to growing a crop while also helping the farmer make money.
This really is a big departure, certainly from the majority of Western farming practices, wherein the only sort of crop you have other than the yield or the produce is perhaps the fallow clover that you introduce during the off-season to try and get more nitrogen back in the soil. These types of cooperative types of farming really takes a different shift in mindset, isn't it? Rather than denying the life of all the plants you don't necessarily harvest, it's encouraging them because that they will in turn support the thing that you are trying to grow and produce.
Right. I mean, it's really a very exciting movement. When you go and look at these regenerative farms, it kind of blows your mind because they don't look like it. I used to love to drive through the Midwest of the United States where you're driving along the highway and there's just row after row after row and field after field of corn shooting by the windows of the car. And I used to think that was just beautiful. And now I just have a completely different view of it. It's kind of an alien landscape. It's a factory floor out in the open. But these regenerative farms are just incredibly exciting in terms of what they're promoting in terms of soil health, what they're promoting in terms of the ability of the soil to hold water, what they're doing in terms of welcoming insects and birds that would ordinarily perish in that landscape.
So how do we take the same sorts of approaches when it comes to our cityscapes? You visited a green roof in Bend, Oregon that might kind of provide a bit of a clue about how to adapt these ideas for the city environment.
Yeah. So one of the things that I did when I worked on this book was to go to a conference in Paris called The Nature of Cities, which brought together these visionaries from all over the world talking about how to bring more nature into cities. And the idea of that is that, you know, one of the ideas behind that is that, you know, we humans didn't come out of a box. We didn't come out of a test tube. We evolved in a very complex ecosystem. And we rely on our connection with nature, with the rest of nature, for our own health and for our own sanity. And so these visionaries were talking about ways to do that. So green roofs are one thing. You know, this rooftop garden that I went to in Bend, Oregon, was one that was not only had a bounteous garden up on this roof level, but it was also a garden that had native species from the area. So it was really, you know, preserving the landscape that the building displaced. And but there were so many examples at this and so many really exciting visionary examples of how we can bring more nature into cities and heal our cityscapes, soften our cityscapes. I'm not sure if you're experiencing terrible heat and drought there where you are right now, but we are in Oregon, which is, you know, when I first moved here 10 years ago, people would say, oh, you're going there to be rained on all the time. Well, not so much these days. You know, we've had terrible, terrible heat and drought. And one of the things that is so obvious now is how city greenery, how trees, city trees change the temperature on the ground, and how in the neighborhoods, and often this is a really terrible case of racial injustice and class injustice. In the neighborhoods that are the poorest and have the most people of color, those are the neighborhoods that have the fewest trees, where it's just hotter and bleaker as the temperatures rise. So, I mean, it's not just a nice idea. It's not just a pretty idea, even though it is very pretty having more greenery in cities. but there's just so many ways that bringing nature into our cities will make our cities healthier place for us and can also offer refuge to animals who, you know, animals like birds and insects and even mammals who are having a tough time surviving in some of the bleak farming situations that we've got going on.
Another really fascinating example, and you even write about Singapore as a poster child for this movement, is the greening of roofs in that city state. And the other interesting factor with that example is that Singapore, I think, imports something like 97% of their food produce. So the idea here is not only to sort of increase green coverage and reduce city temperatures, but also reduce food mileage. Tell me about Singapore and their leading the way, if you like, when it comes to greening a city.
They have done such wonderful things in terms of greening the city. I mean, they have, even as the number of people living there has increased, so has the amount of greenery, so has the amount of green cover. And they have this wonderful idea, which I think should be popularized everywhere, about having every person know the names and know something about the native species of the area so that people embrace those species. You know, if you have a name for something, you're much more likely to protect it and to care for it.
Just lastly, Kristen, when it comes to introducing some hope for our ideal of balancing nature with humanity, how do you maintain your optimism? In reading and writing this book, you must have really found some strands which do give us hope, that do give us some optimism that these two elements of our planet can live in harmony.
I really do feel very optimistic. I think probably, I mean, there are so many stories in there that warm my heart. But I think maybe the one that gave me the most hope was the story of the ranchers in Eastern Nevada, who were persuaded by scientists and government agencies. And you may not know this, but in that part of Eastern Nevada, there has not always been a very good relationship between ranchers and government agencies. But anyway, in this case, ranchers were persuaded to work with scientists and government agencies on changing the way they grazed their cattle because the streams had become so degraded that they were had become an imperfect and dangerous environment for local trout. So these ranchers did start to change their grazing practices, even though some of them kind of felt like, well, this is the way this landscape has always been. We're not going to change things that much. But what happened, and it was troublesome for them to do it. You know, it's troublesome for people to make change, for people to do things in a way that they haven't always done them. But they did start to notice that when they grazed the animals differently and sort of protected the creek banks more, more vegetation started growing along the creek banks. And then the real miracle happened, which is that beavers showed up. Beavers showed up and started to make dams. And the ranchers were really concerned about that at first because they sort of viewed beavers as their enemy. You know, beavers were the things that messed up their ranch irrigation systems. Beaver made, the beaver would make these big ponds and the ponds would spread out and the cattle would get stuck in the ponds. And at first it just seemed like this was making their lives only harder. But what happened over the course of a number of years is that these landscapes completely changed. So what had been a really degraded, desertified landscape, with the help of the changed grazing practices and the beaver, became wet meadows. And the water table of these whole areas changed. You know, it just completely changed. It completely changed the landscape. I mean, looking at the before and after pictures was stunning. And it wasn't only stunning that people working with, you know, allowing the beavers to take over, it wasn't only stunning that the landscapes had changed, because I have seen that over and over again. If people get out of the way and stop doing things that messes up the rest of nature, nature can really rebound very quickly. But what was really moving about that story was how hard these people who had been at loggerheads, you know, who didn't always get along on what was the best thing to do, but how these ranchers and agency officials and scientists meeting together and really working on a cooperative, giving, kind relationship with each other, how they were able to work together and work through some very gnarly problems together. So that, you know, that story was not only about nature healing, but about human relationships healing. So that really mattered to me a lot.
Yeah, it really is an incredible power to harness not only nature, but, you know, humans' ability to collaborate and cooperate and to try and get that win-win-win situation, as you described. Well, I've absolutely enjoyed having your company in the drawing room tonight. And congratulations on the book, Kristen.
Thank you, Andy. It was really great talking to you.
Kristen Olson has been my guest in the drawing room. Sweet in Tooth and Claw is out now through Scribe.
You've been listening to a podcast of The Drawing Room with me, Andy Park. For more great conversations, search for The Drawing Room on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.